welcome to Dungeons & Drama Nerds, a podcast exploring the intersection of theater and tabletop role-playing games. I'm Percy, here today with ensemble member Meeks.
Hello.
Today, we're here with another episode of our Dark Times series between actual play campaigns, and we will be talking about how location informs story in games and plays, with a specific focus on the horror genre. To kick us off, Meeks, could you talk a little bit about the importance of location to your own practice, both as a playwright and GM? And for context, Meeks like pitched this episode and has, I assume, a lot of strong feelings about this topic. So I'd love to hear where you're at with it personally.
Yeah, so I teach horror. Like, it's one of those things that, like, I teach horror playwriting a lot. There's actually an episode coming out on the Playwright Center podcast specifically about, like, my approach to teaching horror coming out soon. But one of the things that I find really fascinating about location is a note that I got while I was in grad school, which was more of a comment than a note. And it was from like a visiting somebody who just happened to like be visiting that day in my workshop. And he said this thing about how what was so great about this play was that the characters felt like they were from the soil. And like, it was such a very specific thing that I hadn't really processed. But it occurred to me that, like, as opposed to a lot of playwrights now, or like several playwrights that I love and admire who write setting agnostic, that's not generally what I do for horror ever. I can't like write a setting agnostic play. You know, there's plenty of playwrights who do like plays in the void. This can happen in anywhere, any, you know, like, it's just like, oh, I'm thinking already of a
set.
Yeah, it's like, here, you know, here's this thought about like how to do this cheaply or whatever, right? Like, that's never been my conception of a world. It's always been like, I don't know, the location is super important, and the characters sort of take off from there, because I have found that like the link for me is always figuring out like what has happened in this place before, which is very much like what horror is about. Horror always uses history in some form or fashion. I'm not even saying like old school history, like in 1832, but like actual, just like understanding the history of a location really has an impact on what's happening. And I see that play out so much in the plays that I like to write, in the horror plays that I love, in the horror films that I love, and then also in the games that that really resonate with me. And the ones specifically that I've even led on this podcast, which have been Brundlewood Bay and Bluebeard's Bride, are so location specific and so much about the location driving the action and the characters' reactions. So I do think it's just very much how I think about what works well in horror. It's always from a location. It's always understanding the metaphor and the history and how those two things overlap. Yeah, that's why I pitched this episode. It's like, let's talk about it.
Hell yeah. To sort of frame our conversation, some sort of broad questions that we're kicking around are: how can location inform story? How does this work in horror specifically? What is the role of location in world building? How can it inform the process of character creation, the choices one makes in character, your sort of lived experience of what is happening in the story, either in the theater, at the table, what have you? And I also really love that sense of history, because that's something that I had not considered as like a fundamental aspect of horror. But in fact, it is very much about like what has happened before and how is what's happening now either repeating or diverging.
Yeah, I find history and like having that kind of broad approach to it, is just so integral to how I think about story. And that's part of the reason why most of my plays end up being horror, I think. But yeah, I mean, even when you look at like a film like Scream, it's all based on like what has come before. It's always about that. Every single horror story plays with history in some form or fashion. And of course, there will be an exception. Somebody will be like, well, what about? And I'll say like, sure, fine. But also, like, there was still history before that. Like, it was, yeah. So I don't know. I always find it's like one of the most exciting tools to play with in your toolbox as a writer.
Yeah, totally. And it's so interesting. This is like, I'm already diverging from what I've said that we would do. But I was looking at the Van Vrichten's Guide to Ravenloft source book that Wizards of the Coast published. And it's so interesting that in the beginning of it, there is like a lot of space dedicated to like, what are the different genres of horror and what are the anxieties that they're exploring, which is fascinating to me. Because it wasn't like cosmic horror is about tentacle monsters in alien spaces. It's like, no, cosmic horror is horror about our feelings of insignificance and our fear of being insignificant. I'm like, oh no.
Yeah, I love that too, because like, so not to like spoil an entire class that I teach, but generally like what I talk about are like the building blocks of horror being metaphor, history, and anxiety. And like understanding those anxieties is like such a huge part of it. But I also do think anxiety has a lot to do with metaphor and history and all of those things. Yeah, cosmic horror too, like being about our insignificance in the world. I mean, there's a reason why I know so many of my friends hate alien stories. Like they find those the most terrifying. And it just tells me a lot about them. Like when you find that, like that's the thing that's most terrifying to you, I'm always like, okay, like you've got some issues with the universe maybe. And like in a good way, like in a healthy way. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to feel small in this way. Like I felt small in these other ways. And I want to feel like I have more control and agency in my life than I really do. Which is part of the reason for me why, you know, I fucking love a slasher. Slashers are all about agency and control. Like that's exactly what they're about. So yeah, I love that you broke the rules. And I love Barovia. I'm like one of those people who's like, actually, I don't use Barovia as written, but I love like the outline of Barovia for the Curse of Strahd stuff.
Yeah. Which spoiler, we will get to a little bit later on. The other thing that's surfacing to me, which I think is useful only in terms of framing, is that I love metaphor, history, and anxiety. And I also now I'm making the connection of like, oh, location is the way of making those things visible. The strangeness of the alien landscape is manifesting the feeling of anxiety. It is the metaphor for our fears of insignificance or the unknown. And the fact that we don't know the history of it because it is alien to us is in fact what is scary. So like, yes, I'm with you. I'm here.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. For context, I'm like only recently becoming like a horror girly. I very much like a monster stories person, but had defined myself as like not a horror person, which is like a silly and useless distinction. Like I really like werewolves and shapeshifters and like things like that because I'm a transsexual. But I was very like, I don't like horror movies because I get scared too easily, whatever, whatever. And now I'm like, oh, okay, no, there's like stuff here.
Yeah.
Now that we've sort of laid the groundwork of what we're trying to explore, I will preface by saying in this episode, we're going to review kind of two case study plays, Hell's Canyon by Keiko Green and The Pitchforks by Andrew Kramer, both of which are on NPX. And I'll link those in the show notes if you want to check them out. Although I will warn you in advance, there will probably be some like spoilers for like what happens in the plays. So feel free to pause, go read the two plays and then come back. Although anytime any podcaster says that, I'm like, I'm not doing that.
I never do it either. I'm like, whatever, just tell me what it's about.
Yeah, that's fine. And we're also going to look at two case study TTRPGs. We're going to look at Sleepaway by Jay Dragon and the Barovia setting. From the Ravenloft sort of broader campaign setting for Dungeons and Dragons. I will briefly note the main kind of Ravenloft texts that, like, at least I am familiar with and am drawing from were written for the game's 5th edition, specifically Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft and the Curse of Strahd Adventure Module. Although Ravenloft is old school D&D.
It's really old school.
There is a very, very old Ravenloft map on my wall that I'm looking at right now.
And you say you aren't into horror until recently. Lies, Percy. Lies.
It's true. I've been in denial for so long.
We're gonna have to that's the whole thing, right? Whenever I meet a queer person who's like not into horror, I'm like, really? Like, I just like do this a few times. I'm just like, I just tilt my head a few times, and then finally I'm able to find the thing that's like, oh no, you like horror, you just don't like this. That's okay. Yeah. That's okay. We can find a better one.
Yeah, no, exactly. I like horror. I just don't like movies about strangers invading other people's homes.
Fair.
Anyway, I'm going to kick it over to you, Meeks, to introduce our first case studies play.
Great. So Hell's Canyon is written by Keiko Green. It actually just had its world premiere at Theater Moo very recently. And the sort of... the broad strokes of this play is that it is a band that hasn't really been together for a few years now. Like they just haven't been able to like play together, but they decide to take this weekend retreat together because, you know, again, we're spoiling alert everything. One of the band members has like a secret to reveal. And I say this, but it's done very well. Keiko Green is an amazing playwright. So like there's a lot of wonderful like build up to this. But the band is two white members who are married now, Brad and Claire, and then one Chinese American man named Tommy and one mixed race man named Doug. And then who's also on board is Tommy's sister, who has been involved with the band for many years, but doesn't actually isn't like a member. And she is currently acting as surrogate for the two white members of the band. So that's a lot of like explanation of a family tree, but just so that we have like the context of it. And over the course of the play, they are visiting this cabin in the woods situation called Hell's Canyon. But we start to experience a lot of weird things happening, and we slowly understand the history of this place, but also the history of this band, and also specifically like the colonialism, imperialism, and violence that are sort of innate in this structure of having white people take over this woman's womb. And it's really fucking cool. It is like one of my favorite like things that she's ever written, and I think I've read everything of Keiko's. But it is a really fucking amazing play that also not in the setting is thought of not just as like as a place, but also she's thought about how the set should look as like a cutout doll set, which I think is really interesting in terms of what she's doing. And then she's also playing with the history specifically of the Gold Rush and how specifically like Chinese workers were abused in this time and specifically murdered and whatever. Did I hit all the broad strokes, you think, Percy? Is there something else that I missed?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think the other thing that I would name about the play is that like Hell's Canyon, real place, Hell's Canyon Massacre, which is sort of the like historical event that precipitates a lot of the horror in the play, real thing that happened where Chinese gold miners were murdered by the sort of white people in the area. So there is like a lot of real history that is coming into play, and also like real dynamics in terms of like surrogacy and like these two white band members kind of like taking a song that one of the other members had written and sort of claiming it and having sold it to this like TV producer. Like, yeah, the real actual history of colonization in like real things that happened, but also like the dynamics that we can recognize.
Yeah.
Any sort of highlights in how this play is using location that stick out to you?
Yes. So, the first thing for me that I think is really key with this play is how she's using location not just of the cabin, but the location of what is this character's name? I just blanked on it and I just reread it.
Which character?
Ariel. She's also using the location of Ariel's body as like a location too, in which this war is sort of being waged, which I think is a really it's a really fun play with location as well. What I think is really important here is like again, like where you're sort of seeing this overlap between metaphor, anxiety, and history, and it's all kind of coming together in a really wonderful way. You know, there's a version of this play in which they just sort of like tell you the whole ghost story. Like she just tells you the whole ghost story of the massacre, and like that's what we understand, and then we're waiting for that shoe to drop the entire time. But instead, it's just sort of slowly revealed in these very specific ways, and specific and how the characters are interacting with this space. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that Ariel is sort of being controlled by one of the children in her womb, right? Like this idea that Bolin, who is one of her twin unborn twin babies, is a reincarnation of Bolin, who was massacred in this massacre, and that he actually has controlled her to come to this specific setting for this specific reason, to take revenge on this specific group of people who wronged him, because Ben, one of the white band members, is also like a long relative of the guy who like was a part of this massacre. And he's also the one who sold off the song. So like all of these things like are so intricately laid out, and they're all happening because of this very specific location that has called them home. This is a play that cannot happen if it is not here. It would not happen if they were just like having dinner, weekly dinner at the apartment, right? That's a whole different play. And I think that for me is why it's really exciting, because because you need the blood in the soil in order for this play to happen. You need the fact that they're like on this like really weird switchback mountain of like back and forth weight, like so that there's this threat of escape or the inability to escape. There's all of these fun ways that she does this, and because it's also a real place, I think it heightens that as well. So yeah, she's using horror in so many amazing ways. Just a very gifted playwright, but it's also incredibly scary. And what I tell my students, though, is like it's scary on the page. But what's great about it is it's also a really good story. And that's the thing that I tell my students all the time is like, you can't always control if the production itself will be scary, but you can control if it's a good story. And it is a good story. It's a really fantastic ghost, revenge, murder, mystery kind of feeling.
But she's using all these tropes of like, we're in a remote cabin in the woods and there's scary green eyes peering in through the windows and there's banging on the door and there's these noises. Like, there's all of these things that are not really actually what the horror of the play is, but that's what we're thinking is like, oh, there's going to be some kind of incursion. There's some kind of monster. There's some kind of like thing. But in fact, the real monster was colonization. And it's this like, it's this thing that like took me completely by surprise when I was reading, because I was like, oh, she's using these tropes so brilliantly and saying, okay, coming into this play, you're like, oh, it's set in a cabin in the woods. I know what the threats are going to be. And in fact, that's just not it at all, which I think is brilliant, brilliantly done.
Yeah, I love that she continually subverts that too. I think that's something that is also really key sometimes in these location stories is how do you subvert the trope, especially because we've seen everything. And I'm honestly like, subversion of tropes is so tied to the pitchforks too. Not sure if you're ready to move to the pitchforks and then we can talk about them together, but yeah.
I have one tiny thing that I want to like illuminate from Hell's Canyon. So I will foil your masterful segue and then bring us into the pitchforks. Something like a small detail that I love about this play and its use of location is also the specificity of it's like a very classic, like, we rented an Airbnb for the weekend and we get there and we have to decide who's sleeping where because the room arrangement is like weird, because there's like a master bedroom with like a queen bed, there's a kid's room with a set of bunk beds, and then there's a couch, and there's five people who need like to sleep, and one of them is like 7 months pregnant with the baby of the other of two of the other people, and they get there and there is this like she makes the power dynamics between the characters and the relationship dynamics between the characters so visible through how they allocate the rooms, because Ben and Claire end up in like the bedroom with the regular like real bed, even though everyone is like, should Ariel like get that bed because she's pregnant, and then Ariel and Tommy end up on the bunk beds and Doug is on the couch. And that's just like a small detail that I really, really love too, is the use of like the location of who is sleeping where and the specificity of like who has been given what and what is the status of that, that kind of helps us concretize all of these dynamics of power.
I love that you called that moment out too. And specifically what's so great about how she does that is like the conversation is so reasonable, but it's also like so weird, because Ben and Claire, the couple who are having who have inseminated Ariel, are like concern trolling over her the entire time about how she feels about everything, and are she sure she doesn't want the bed, which is of course ridiculous, and she knows it's ridiculous because they are two people, and like shoving yourselves two people into like a bunk bed or on a couch is really hard. But like, yeah, it's just this weird thing where it's like, why is this continuing to happen? But then yeah, then what's so funny is they do get the master bedroom, which is called specifically the master bedroom, right? And then and then there's a joke about it, about, oh yeah, because you two are the king and queen, and they can't take that joke. They can't take it because their white guilt is so ridiculous in this play, but she just does it so well. And it's just, it's constantly this whole thing of like, we're totally listening to Ariel, we're checking in, we're trying to give her what she needs without ever actually listening to her. And they do that throughout the entire play with everybody. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so good. And it's, and you can, like, the dialogue is constructed in such a beautiful way of like there's all of these things happening at the same time, kind of overlapping in the different rooms of the house, in a way that feels so grounded in the experience that I think many people have had of like, we're going on a retreat for the weekend and like the vibes are kind of off and like there's all these tensions that we're not addressing. but yes, I will swing us into The Pitchforks by Andrew Kramer, which is a play that is about It's we're set in a seedy kind of motel room on Halloween. We're like out, I think, in the desert, like very remote. Even like the staff is not there. They left like a note with the keys to this group of people who we know only by their last names in the script. And it is revealed that like there's all this film style narration that the characters do that kind of bring us in. It's there's these four people, Watterson, Sellers, Jutland, and Fowler, that are having some kind of like reunion, or it's like an annual meeting. It's kind of unclear what's going on. And then it becomes clear it's definitely like these are four closeted gay guys who have like a yearly, like they get together and they just like fuck for the whole weekend. And then they go back to their regular lives and their wives and whatever. And throughout there's this revenant who's there who is like turning off all the lights and threatening them and all of that. And it comes to be revealed that there was a fifth pitchfork, because that's the name of the group, the Pitchforks. There's a fifth one. They killed him and hid his body in the wall of the motel, and the revenant is here to like get his revenge. There's all of these scary things that happen. And then the fourth wall breaks, someone comes over the god mic, the play stops, and we shift. And we're in this conference room in this office building. We're in this room with this assistant, some producers, a director, and then the revenant comes back as somebody who wrote this movie called The Pitchforks, which is the first half of the play, and is pitching it. And it's these execs who are talking about, you know, can we really do like a gay movie? Like, I don't know about this. And then Cord, who was the revenant in the first half, becomes the revenant once more and kills all of them, or forces them to kill themselves rather. And the assistant, who is like the only other gay person in the room, is like he's like, perhaps you will have the power to produce the movie as written. And it's a play that is very much about the need for queer horror, the inherent queerness of horror, who like intended audiences and mass appeal, and like the fraughtness of trying to appeal universally and all of these things. The first half of which is a demonstration of what like queer horror that is unafraid to be just like about gay people, and the complicatedness of their particular lives, is. So yes, that was a much more fragmented summary of the play.
No, but you hit it all. Yeah.
Amazing. And yeah, unfortunately, like we've left some mystery about Hell's Canyon, but there is just no way to talk about the Pitchforks without sort of revealing.
Yeah, because it really hinges on that twist. But like Andrew Kramer does try to like not spoil it even in the first few pages. Like I think in the way that he writes the character descriptions, he's like, these are who is in this cast, and then they become, well, wait and see. Like he does a lot of those sort of tricks, which I appreciate. Playwright to playwright, sometimes you do want to have like a, you know, as you know, like sometimes you do want to hold on to one of those things, and because it's not going to hold up if they know that it's coming.
Yeah, exactly.
I am curious to know, yeah, like how you, because I think I told you off mic, like my students have such weird reactions to this. And so, and you had already sort of alluded that you had kind of some strange reactions to this. So, like for you and the location of this play, like what was it doing for you or not doing for you?
I loved the first half of this play. I was like, I'm so here for it. Like, I love that it's just like putting these sort of, I don't want to say predictable because that sounds pejorative, but like these things that make sense and the particularities of them are still surprising and scary. It is this like ghost revenge story. I was like so here for it, and then the shift happened, and it became what felt to me such a like almost like sanitized feeling, like conversation that I've seen like a million times about like making gay things for gay people and the unwillingness of like companies with lots of money to support that because they're afraid that it'll alienate straight people, whatever, whatever. And I'm sort of like, I can't tell if I'm supposed to find that also scary, but like I don't. Like I don't know. I had trouble sort of, there was like a feeling of like kind of being let down in it because it became so transparently like we're talking about what has already happened. Yeah, I don't know. It like I feel complicated about it because I'm sort of like the horror of the play kind of dissipated for me because I understand the ways in which the like Hollywood executive conference room can be a space of horror, but it didn't like hit me the same way, you know?
Yeah, no, it's I wanted to ask because every single time I assign this for my horror playwriting class, my queer students have this exact reaction, and my straight students are like, I didn't realize what was going on in the first part of the play, and in like a very sweet way, like not in a judgmental way, but like I think one thing that we can say is like the orgy stuff is like really intense. Like there's like it is very graphic in a
They are
very.
fucking.
They are fucking, they are playing a game about guess whose cock you're sucking. Like, it's very, very queer, very, very hot. Like, it's very, like, there's a lot of S&M happening. There's a lot of, like, cool stuff happening that you never see. And I'll say, like, it's done kind of in blackout. Like, there's no simulated sex on stage or anything. It doesn't seem like. But yeah, my students always have, like, it's always sort of polarized in this way where my straight students actually find the second half so necessary because they didn't know this stuff, right? But all my queer students are like, why? And I'm just like, yeah, this is why I think this play is so interesting in terms of, and thinking of like the executive suite, as it were, as a location of horror, I find really fascinating. But I do always find myself sort of glazing over in that second half because I'm like, I know all of this. I know this stuff about these things.
Yeah, there's something disappointing about like the point that this, I assume, queer playwright is making. Sort of not being practiced in the play that is being written because it doesn't feel like it is for it feels like it is intended to be a moment of vindication for queer people who are watching or reading the play, but it doesn't land like that for me. It sort of just lands as like, oh right, sure. And because I'm very like, okay, yes, I am aware, I got it. The moment of catharsis at the end where the revenant comes back is like, oh, okay, like whatever.
Yeah, and I'll say like rereading it too this time, I was like, this could have happened much sooner. Like because I think that would have split the difference nicely. But I do think like to focus on like the location of the first part of it, what I love about it is that it is playing so much with the hotel tropes, with the revenge fantasy of like this person died, and was like closeted when he died and is now shoved literally in a different kind of closet, but they're coming back to have this rendezvous, and how that the location being on top of literally somebody who has died is really also a good trope, and is used very well.
Well, like, yeah, and the setting elements of like the light and sound, the specificities of lighting as dictated in the script, the like thunderstorm outside, all of the like we don't see it, but we don't see it, but there's this moment where the Revenant, like, one of the characters had like a dog that I believe had died. And the dog like reappears and is like thrown onto the hood of his truck parked outside, and like there's like woof woof written in blood on the like there's all of these things that are like really satisfying and cool because I do think, and I'm speaking from a place of like non-expertise here, and I very well could be wrong. I don't think there's a lot of like successful like slashery plays, and this feels like it falls into like the first half of this very much I think falls into the category of like a classic like slashery scary movie kind of play. With the very specific circumstances of these characters.
Yeah, the only other like slasher that I know of that well, and I mean, there's a few of them that try to do something, but like Lauren Yu's Hookman is a great example, I think, of a good slasher for the stage. But otherwise, like it's a really hard genre to play in. So I appreciate so much what it's doing in that regard, and I appreciate so much of what's off stage with it as well, which is maybe not about location, but has more to do with just like respect for like how hard it is to do horror on stage, and like how the scary of the unseen is what I really appreciate about this particular play, and I do love this first half of it so much. And so like that's the thing is like is I assign it because I think it's just so satisfying in the first part of it, and specifically because it plays so well with like the toxic masculinity and homoeroticism, which is very fun for both Percy and I. We were chatting about it earlier this morning, but like it plays so well with that, where it's like immediately, they're coming in all these like masculine bro energies and talking about, oh yeah, like gonna do this thing, and like then they all just like become these like fucking like you know, pansies in a great way, in a very satisfying way. Pansies in like in a very traditional sense of the word, as they like figure out how much they really just like fucking each other, and they should just do that all the time, and it makes you sad, and it also is like, but they're assholes. Oh, it's so fun when people are complicated. I have all of these feelings about this play.
Yeah, and I think there is a way in which these two plays use the unknown and the unseen very differently, because I think in Keiko's play it's very much like a misdirect, and in the Pitchforks it's very much, I think, the where the horror comes from. Like, I think part of the what is scary about Hell's Canyon is that like everything has been there the whole time, kind of, and it's just like you learn information that recontextualizes what you've already seen and understood about the relationships between these people, that is like, oh, it goes so much deeper than I had realized. Whereas the Pitchforks is very much, I think, operating on the reveal and the reveal and the reveal.
Yeah, I like that framing of it. I like that framing of it a lot, because it is, yeah, I think that the Pitchforks very much is like, okay, every single time you think you know what's going on, we're pulling it out from under you, versus, yeah, Keiko's is very much, no, if you're aware, like, you've got it from jump. Like, this is what we're doing. And even if you are an aware queer person watching the Pitchforks, it's still based on subversion. Everything is about, because you never think they're going to go and do this thing. Like, as a queer person watching the horror, you're like, no. They're not actually going to say what it is. Like, they can't. They can't. They do! Like, and that's...
Exactly.
That's the joy of it. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think both of them are using sort of classic horror locations of like remote cabin and seedy motel in ways that are both playing into those tropes and subverting them in a way that I think is really satisfying, because I think part of what makes horror function is the use of like trope and the like these locations that we can all kind of agree are potentially very scary for a variety of reasons. And the journey is in part finding out the particularities of why this specific one is or is not scary in ways that we may or may not expect.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts about Hell's Canyon or the Pitchforks before we jump to some games?
Read those plays.
Please do read those plays. They are so good.
They're really good.
Even though I have dunked a little bit on the Pitchforks, I did also love it very much.
It's my feeling every single time I assign it is like, I love it, and also you will love part of it, and then you will not love another part of it. So,
yeah, but also I can't deny that like I can understand the motivation for the part of it that I did not personally love. I just am not necessarily, as an artist, interested in making things that make straight people go, oh, I haven't thought about it that way before.
Yeah, and I think to be fair, I think the draft that we read was from 2019, and I think that he had been working on it for a few. So it's still like, it's still, if we're just thinking about how far, and debatable how far we have come, but like in the sense of like where we are time wise already, like there was definitely more need to explain ourselves even 3 years ago. So like,
oh my God, 2019 was 5 years ago.
It was 5 years ago, buddy. Yeah, isn't that weird?
That's disgusting.
Yeah, right. So, you know, and I'm curious if Andrew Kramer got a chance to like workshop it today, how it would change, because I bet it would. I bet it would. I bet he'd be like, oh, I don't have to explain half this shit now. We live in a post like Scream revival world now. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. I have so many feelings about the Scream franchise and the way that it thinks about horror tropes, but that's sort of outside the scope of this conversation.
Oh, we're going to take a walk soon and we're going to have a whole conversation about it, because I would love to.
I watched Scream 6 and I was like, it's got, things have progressed so far. Anyway. We're going to talk about J Dragon's Sleepaway. Basically, the premise of this game, you play a group of camp counselors. You're at a summer camp. You're handling like all the campers. You're doing regular camp stuff. But there's also a horrible eldritch beast called the Lindworm, who haunts your camp and wreaks havoc and introduces all of this strangeness. And it's killing animals. It's killing the adult staff of the camp. It's killing campers. It is threatening the existence of your camp and your very lives. And you play out sort of contending with all of these things. The big, I think, location thing to highlight about this game is that the setting elements, as in many Belong Outside Belonging games, are collaboratively defined and controlled. So not just the locations like the field, the woods, and the lake, but also the campers, the magic of the camp, and the strangeness, which is like this, the horror elements that the Lindworm brings in. as well as ones that just like exist in a camp setting. So that's, I think, the big location thing. Do you have thoughts or feelings about Sleepaway's use of location?
I have so many. So I love this game so much. I know you do too. One of the things that I love about it so much is that you're physically also playing as the location as well as your character, which I think is just so much about what I love about horror and specifically why I wanted to have this conversation. Like, I think I proposed it because we were doing Sleepaway. And I was like, yeah, or like, I'm like, that's a game that's going to be played. Like, we have to talk about location. And the other thing that I really love about the location and how it's sort of communally built is, and I don't want to spoil the game, but I will say that at certain points, there are certain things that could happen depending on what you draw from these cards as you play with No Dice, No Masters. Is the locations disappear sometimes in really, really traumatic ways. And I love that too, because I think there's something specifically about the death of location in horror that is like really, it's really interesting. You know, these places of safety and comfort can sort of disappear. And so like for me, like, I mean, I think like that's something that I see a lot in like horror TV shows because they just have more time to do it. But, you know, when you're looking at like Buffy, very old school Buffy, right? Like literally destroying the high school, which granted was not the safest of places and yet was like still like a place of comfort. The library and all of those places like get physically destroyed, you know, and then in the end of the show, they completely destroy the whole Hellmouth, right? They destroy Sunnydale. Like the death of location is really interesting. And then in something like The Walking Dead, where like every season something is destroyed as well. Every location that was safe is now completely like turned in a different way. I find highly satisfying as a viewer because it just, it does make people act differently depending on which location they're in, which is like, again, why I was interested in this episode. So for me, Sleepaway is so satisfying because of those reasons, like because it actually, you get to build this place that's so lovely and warm and then the Lindworm like makes it bad and then you have to destroy it and it's so cool.
Yeah, and in case you're unfamiliar with Sleepaway, mechanically something that I love that it does is that nobody is playing as the Lindworm, and throughout the handbook it is so specific about like you do not role play as the Lindworm. It is supposed to be, I don't know in physical play how like successful this is, but like whoever is acting as the Lindworm is anonymous. Like you're all like closing your eyes and somebody draws the cards and decides, because the Lindworm has a deck of playing cards and you draw cards and you decide out of the three that you draw which one happens and to whom, or is it like a general thing, and then you sort of play out the consequences of that. But it's very specific about like nobody is the antagonist of this and nobody is taking on that role. Both because like there's a moment in the beginning of the game where you like invite the Lindworm to come and play with you and you give like 30 seconds for it to respond, which is terrifying. But yeah, it's so specific about like nobody is playing the direct thing that is causing horror that you are fighting, which I think is important. But you are playing as these setting elements and you have moves that you can do. Like the moves for the field setting element are like, invite a moment of healthy communication, resolve tensions through play, create injury without meaning to. Like you have these motivations and things that are suited to what that environment is good at, which I think is like an incredible sort of activation of what we've been talking about.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the summer camp too is just so, I mean, it, like in terms of what we've already been talking about with metaphor, history, and anxiety, it's a place rife with all of those things. And because you're playing as the counselors, and so like I wrote an entire play about this very like transparently, like it's part of the reason why I love this so much is I wrote a play called The Lost Girls that's about being a summer camp counselor. But what's so weird about being a summer camp counselor is that you're barely older than these children, and yet you're like still kind of like these children, and you're supposed to be in charge of them. And so like I think that's what it also does really well, as like putting these characters, these counselors, like right on the verge of adulthood. And I think you can actually choose an age range that you want to do, and the age range of the campers themselves. But I think all of that really then makes the horror that much more interesting, especially as you're playing with the set elements, because you're literally embodying the horror that's happening in the ground, in soil, which I find very fun and very satisfying as a player.
Do you want to pivot to Barovia?
Curse of Strahd and Barovia. So I will say that my intro to Barovia is Curse of Strahd, and I have many feelings. I think the podcast has talked many times about your all's like also feelings about D&D. It's not like the best system or anything like that. But the campaign setting of Barovia itself is so fascinating to me, because it is this huge sandbox. And as soon as you start to understand the history of this place and sort of like what the elements are to play with, it becomes a very easy setting to adapt to whatever you kind of want to do. So like the main features of it, right, is that it's like a very kind of Transylvanian like place where it's like a destitute people who are being ruled by a vampire villain who has like, you know, made this place kind of unlivable. Everybody in Barovia is usually sad and is usually like at the end of like a hard season, of a hard winter, a hard whatever. Like they all just seem to be struggling in a very specific way. But then there's also, you know, hags and witches and whatever, and lots of like fun people to play against who all have these really weird, weird motivations for things, that I find highly fun to embody, including like a bishop that is like kind of a deity but also really fucked up. And like, my favorite though are the night hags. And that became like one of the things that we played with a lot when we ran this campaign was like the night hags and how they can kind of control the world. Because again, I don't play these games as they are written. I'm always like, I want to take this. Mm-hmm. So what I love about Barovia and its use of location is like as soon as you understand its mechanics, you can really put anything in it. And like for me as a DM, like that's what's really rewarding is like the location does like give you certain parameters, but it also lets you do some really fucked up things. So like even like a session that my players still talk about, one, we talk about Sleepaway all the time because we love playing Sleepaway. But the other one is this day in Barovia where I gave them a quote unquote break, where all of a sudden there was a Waffle House in the middle of Barovia. And we played this whole thing out where like all of a sudden there was like this thing of this particular, like in this setting, there was this thing. But because like the location of Barovia was so specific, it was so weird and fun to try to figure out the location of the Waffle House inside of Barovia and like, uh-huh, what are the things that exist in that particular place that we all know as touchstones of a Waffle House. Like,
was the Waffle House in Valaki?
No, it was just on the path, but it should have been in Valaki. No, it was just like on the path, but it was like, it was this thing where this was like post like having like confronted the night hags, but one of them got away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a spell. It's all fun, right? But like there's literally theater kids drinking endless amounts of coffee in there. There's like, you know, there's just like lots of these tropes that you can play on and then slowly twist the knife. In that horror Barovian way where suddenly they were like, yeah, this is weird. What is this doing here? And then they slowly realize that the night hag is still there and they haven't killed her. So I don't know. It was still one of my favorite sessions. So I think about it often. So yeah, I don't know. I just rambled a lot about Barovia. You speak. what are your thoughts?
I think one of the big things, something cool that I think may have been true before, but they've concretized, is that like Ravenloft as like a world or like a setting is like this land of fog in which there are a bunch of little demiplanes that are ruled over by these dark lords is what they're called, which is a hilarious name for it. But like Strahd is like the dark lord of his domain. But something that I think is like particularly cool about Barovia as written in like Curse of Strahd is that it was like a real place that existed in the world, and then through Strahd's like immortal pact and his influence, it got pulled out, and all of the people who lived there are suddenly trapped in this fog enclosed place that they can no longer leave. Yeah. And there's all these specificities in both the Ravenloft campaign guide and the Strahd module about like reincarnation is super complicated. Like if you, a player character, get reincarnated, I think within 24 hours, I think you're fine. But if it's like a longer timeline, you're like have some kind of Barovian madness that persists, which like perhaps problematic, but that's not really relevant to this particular conversation. But there's like your soul is trapped in this demiplane because it is the specific domain of this person and you can't leave unless he allows you to, which of course he wouldn't. I don't know. I'm starting to ramble, but I think like the question for me is a lot of like what is scary about adventuring in Barovia, and how much of that is tied to Strahd as a figure, versus his dread domain? And like, are those things actually completely inextricable from each other? And what does that mean for the location based horror of this campaign setting to be produced exclusively by its main antagonist? You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really fun question. I mean, for me, and yeah, I think like there's a lot of, we could talk all day about some of the problematic elements, especially in the original, like, Strahd as written, because it's just got a lot of that kind of stuff. But I think
let's set the Vistani aside entirely.
Oh my God. I don't want to talk about the Vistani. well, yeah, like that was a whole different navigation when we were playing it. I was like, how are we going to talk about this? And so we just
the funniest
talk
thing
about
the Ravenloft guide is that they talked a huge game. They were like, we're fixing the Vistani, and I'm like, no, you didn't.
You're not. You're just saying that you're not going to say this, like the contradictory
G-slur.
Right? Like, it's just, come on now. But what's interesting, because it is a domain that is so like shaped by, basically, like the way I like to think about it is it's a place that is shaped entirely by Strahd's like unhappiness. Like so for me, and you know, one of the things I love about monsters and monster theory and like how it all works is like monsters are our children is like specifically like a thing that is said in the Cohen reading that's like the seven theses of monster theory. And Strahd's no different. You know, like he's a monster, but he's also human and he's sad. Like he's just fucking sad. And like, yes, that has become like a twisted thing and all of that. But it means that like every single like moment in Barovia is really governed by humanity that feels too intense to deal with is kind of how I think about it. Which is why everybody has become quote unquote mad, again, a kind of problematic way of talking about it now, but like in the way of like how they approach things. Like I was talking about the bishop's character, like he's somebody who has like basically just sort of warped his view of like how he can fix the world because he has been, for lack of a better word, infected by this place, and the way that his humanity or lack thereof is sort of functioning is like, I can fix it. I'll just make the perfect woman. And it's like, problematic, so many things, but like we, you know, I like that. I like that this is a place where instead of it just sort of devolving into this person is so evil and so monstrous and so whatever, it always comes back to humanity and that humanity is tied to the land. I find that really a fun dynamic to play with.
Yeah, because I think, like, I'm looking now at the, like, role-playing Strahd section of the book, and I'm kind of like, this doesn't feel true to me, actually, because it's like, Strahd believes his soul is lost to evil, he feels neither pity nor remorse, neither love nor hate, and it's like, actually, his entire sort of conflict that he is, like, the whole, like, pursuit of Arena and all of these things is, in fact, just, like, he is lost in emotion and he doesn't want to acknowledge it. Yeah, I don't know. It's... Yes. That's my non-nuanced sort of thought about it, is that I think you're right that like perhaps even this adventure module misunderstands where the horror is coming from, because I think D&D so often is like the horror is because there are monsters and there's the horrible windmill fight and there's all of these like things that are that could physically threaten you, but in fact the thing that's scary about Curse of Strahd is not the random encounter table where sometimes you have to fight some wolves or a fucking vampire spawn or something. Like it's actually like realizing what's happening in the village of Barovia and Valaki. It's realizing that the Waffle House that you have taken respite in is in fact created by the existential dread of like being in this place that is ruled by someone who is deeply and irreparably sad, who has taken these people from where they live and trapped them here. Like that's what's scary about Curse of Strahd.
And it's so funny that you were literally like reading out how they tell you to play Strahd, because I completely forgot about that and I obviously ignored it, because every single quote unquote villain, and I don't know if you do this too, but whenever I'm like creating something, like the least interesting choice is always to make somebody a pure villain. It's always least interesting choice. Like it's way more fun. Like with the Night Hags even, I'm always like, well, they want children because they want to reproduce, because they want to like have family. What does family mean? And like that seems silly. Because they're Night Hags, but also it's like, no, but it's true. And like the reason why she built the Waffle House in the middle of Barovia is because these fucking adventurers killed her family.
Yeah.
And like that's fucking terrible. How dare you? Like it's like that's not okay. So I will trap you in my Waffle House and you're gonna eat some pancakes and then you're gonna feel really sick. It's gonna be great. And so, you know, I think Yeah, I think it's really funny sometimes that D&D doesn't understand its own material and like what's the most interesting choice? And the most interesting choice is always the human side of the thing. Even the people who are villains. I mean, like this was the thing. Joss Whedon is so problematic, and I know I've already mentioned Buffy once here, but like what Buffy got right about villains was always the human side. They making somebody more human always makes it more interesting about why they are a villain. Having people care about each other, even if it's fucked up and weird, is what makes it interesting. Scream, we've already talked about, but part of the reason why that movie is so great is because of Billy and Stu and their fucking interesting ass relationship that is so hot.
They're so in love with each other.
They are.
And Matthew Lillard is so hot.
He's so hot and so is Skeet Ulrich. Oh my God. Like these two fucking hot ass men who just want to get it on, but instead they're gonna go punish their like the girlfriends instead because they can't be with each other. But I
Well,
mean,
and like also frankly speaking, like I don't necessarily know that I would respond the same way, but like sure, Skeet Ulrich's character absolutely has like a reason for what he's doing that is rooted in like he feels hurt about this thing that deeply affected his life, and sure he's taking it out on the wrong person, and sure, you know, whatever, whatever. I was having a conversation with my friend last night actually about because I just watched The Green Knight finally, and like as an Arthurian legend girly, like I don't know how it took me so long to watch it, but like whatever. But we were talking a lot about like heroism as a concept and whatever, and like this weird turn recently to like. Or maybe not recently. There was like a phase in like superhero comics at least where everybody was like, what if being a hero was bad actually? What if Superman was the villain all, you know what I mean? And it's this like such a sort of shallow understanding of like what being a villain is, and it's like actually just we're all acting in our interest, and occasionally the sort of specificities of what we are willing to let go of in order to get what we want are bad or harmful, but it depends on like it's all of these things. So yeah, I agree that it's sort of like way more interesting if Strahd is not this like figure who is like, I am doomed and therefore I do not have any empathy or care at all about anything.
Well, and like not to bring too many Marvels into this, but like that's part of the reason why the X-Men was the most successful of this, like in my opinion, right? Like has always been one of the more interesting and successful franchises is because mutants aren't one thing. They aren't just heroes. Like we are, like every single person is complex. Even people who agree with you will have fucked up ways of getting what they want and are still like human and will fuck up and do things poorly. So like part of the reason why X-Men works is because Eric, like Magneto, is like kind of an asshole, but also he's kind of right. And like that's what makes it fun to watch and engage with. And so, yeah, and I think, I don't know if we've like deviated too much from location, but like,
Well,
I
I think
mean,
location, like we were talking about earlier, is concretizing all of these things. It is the easiest way to make all of these power dynamics and motivations and desires visible. And you feel them because it's your environment that you're in. And the more all of these conflicts are grounded in the specificity of a place, whether it's like a genre of place, like a hotel room or a cabin in the woods, or, you know, Hell's Canyon, I don't know what state it's officially in, but like the location of Hell's Canyon or the location
Oregon.
of Barovia, like the more it is something that is specific, the more you're able to use the specifics of what's happening in the location and what it looks like and feels like and smells like and whatever to like make all of these anxieties, histories, and metaphors visible.
Yeah. Very well said.
Thank you. To sort of bring us to a conclusion, a question that I have is, are you noticing any big differences between the use of location in like these two plays versus in the TTRPG, either settings or games that we've talked about?
I'm fascinated by so like right the idea of the plays is that it's actually the play world is almost always like a very narrow scope, right? You're looking at like one set, box set location usually, and that's very true for Keiko's play. There is sort of a breaking, as we've talked about, breaking the world in the pitchforks, but more or less it's like one box set. He even says it in the beginning.
Yeah,
He's like
it's
it's
one thing
one.
and then it's another thing.
Yeah. But what's great, right, about the TTRPG and what's great about role playing in general, and I'm not sure how you feel about maps and things, but I'm much more of like a theater of the mind trained person when it comes to TTRPGs. But like, that's sort of what I love about it is like, is that it becomes such a sprawling place. And while there might be some touchstones, like Barovia is huge, like it's ginormous. It is one of the biggest locations I have ever played in.
But I also think the appeal of the Curse of Strahd adventure is that it is kind of a sandbox.
Yeah, 100%. And then with Sleepaway, like it is, it's not as big a sandbox because there are touchstones within that location, but it's also a location that we know super well. I don't know about you, but I actually don't know very many Cabin in the Woods, and I don't know very many seedy hotel rooms. So like, it is funny like how we sort of do that, but like the summer camp I'm very familiar with. Like, I'm very familiar with what a summer camp is and what it feels like, which is part of the reason why I think it's like, it's one, a great place to theatricalize, and it's a fun place to play in as a TTRPG, because we generally all have a touchstone of like, what does it mean to be on the dock on the lake? What does it mean to be in a large field? What does it mean to be in a cabin?
Certainly do if we're drawn to playing this game. Like, I think a lot of people want to play this game because it is something that they've lived.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's interesting, but I do think there's definitely room for, you know, there's a great play by Julia Jarko where it does feel more like a void play. Mm-hmm. And it's just called The Terror, or The Terrifying. It's called The Terrifying. And it feels more of like a void play. There are locations, but there's not like a whole lot of like specific places. And so in that way, I do see like a relationship to like it being more of a sandbox idea of like where you're coming from. Yeah, I don't know if I have any like great thoughts about it outside of those things. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. What strikes me about what you just said is that like Cabin in the Woods and Seedy Hotel Room are like locations that we're familiar with because we have watched movies or watched TV or whatever, and summer camp and sprawling remote valley with some towns are things that we probably have experience with because we have lived or visited. And I don't have like a conclusion about that, but that's interesting to me. But yeah, I don't necessarily see a fundamental difference in how these two sort of like mediums are using location to produce horror, because I think the fundamental experience of like watching something happen in it versus being the character actually doesn't matter that much, because if the play is successful, it feels the same as if you were traversing it.
I agree with that. Yeah. Again, it's always about telling a good story. It's very rarely about trying to scare people, which is frustrating to a lot of my students. They're like, I just want to know how to scare people. And I'm like, tell a good story.
Yeah.
That's all you can control.
No, absolutely. Yeah. My last sort of like question is a question that I think we've already answered, but I'm feeling an urge towards the concrete. Are there like takeaways that we might draw from this conversation about like playwriting, game design, devising, et cetera, that is like trying to be scary about using location effectively beyond like be specific about location versus setting things in a void?
So the thing that I really think is important with all of this, and we've talked about it a little bit, is like understanding a place's history, right? And understanding that location has personality. I think this is why we picked these particular case studies of the games, right? It's like Sleepaway is fascinating because you literally play as locations, and like those locations have a distinct way of acting, and distinct memories they're going to elicit from you, distinct actions that you can take while you're using them. And I think like that all comes back to the history of the place. One of the big exercises that I often take my students through is about understanding like how history changes depending on who's telling something, and just like through a ghost story, like how you can change it so quickly just based on who's telling it and why they're telling it. There's a great book by Colin Dickey, who I love. If you have not read Colin Dickey, you should read Colin Dickey, but he wrote this book called Ghostland. And specifically, there's a chapter in Ghostland called The Devilish Place, which is about Richmond, Virginia. And he talks about how in Richmond, Virginia, which was like a huge slave trading port, all of the ghost stories told in a lot of the commercially viable areas are always about white ghosts, right? So like he's drawing this conclusion about how even though this is a town that horrific things were done specifically to enslave Black people, like that this was a town that was so invested in its capitalist mentality that it only wanted to tell ghost stories about its white people, who were all pleasant like saloon girls and all of that kind of stuff, right? Like it was that kind of vibe. And I find when I teach that, and I have students write a ghost story, they start to understand a lot more like the power of the story and how like that's all that really matters when you're trying to figure out the location is like who's got a vested interest in telling a story a specific way and who's going to change it and who's going to understand it in a different way. So yeah, I don't know. I think like that's the really big takeaway for whenever you're running a game or playing a game or writing a play, like is just like, what's the history? What's the history and who's saying it and why are they saying it this way?
Yeah, and the more specific that history is tied to a place as opposed to like, because like, sure, you could write like a version of Hell's Canyon that is just about like the gold rush and the conflict of that, but the fact that it is this one particular place where this one particular thing happened is what makes it so like specificity, I think, always just makes things better. And I would argue probably scarier because I think the more specific a threat you can describe, the more viscerally you can imagine it, the scarier it is, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is a phenomenal place for us to leave it, unless you have any final thoughts about location and horror.
I've talked plenty.
Well, thank you all listeners for joining us. We'll see you next month with another Dark Time episode. And until then, don't put your plays in voids. Dungeons and Drama Nerds is produced by Percival Hornack and Nicholas Orvis, and this episode was mixed and edited by Percival Hornack. Our core ensemble are Todd Brian Backus, Giovanni Camagno, Anthony Sertel Dean, Christopher Dirksen, Ben Ferber, Corey Flores, Mieko Gavia, Tess Huth, Romana Isabella, John John Johnson, CJ Linton, C. Meeks Meeker, Leo Mock, Dex Fan, and Tristan B. Willis. If you'd like to help us continue exploring the intersections of theater and tabletop role-playing games, consider leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice or supporting us, and getting access to our patron-only bonus content at patreon.com/dungeonsanddramanerds. You can find our social media and website links, including our cast bios, at the link tree in our show notes, and be sure to tune in soon for another episode of Dungeons and Drama Nerds.